It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Suicide rates in the United States are the highest they've been in 30 years. But no matter what statistics show us, each individual loss to suicide is devastating. Survivors are left with grief, anger, questions, and often a sense of guilt, as if they didn't try hard enough to help. Tragically, one suicide can also lead to others. This hour, we'll talk about suicide. Find out who's particularly at risk, how to support survivors, how to protect other vulnerable people in the wake of a tragedy, and the possibilities of prevention. A little later on in the hour, I'll talk with Carrie Neblett of the Crisis Center of Johnson County and Sherry Jenkins. She's a suicide loss survivor and facilitator of the Families of Suicide Loss Support Group in Davenport. My first guest today is John Westerfeld, Professor Emeritus in the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Iowa. Hello, John.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the show. And tell me a little bit about your personal history, because your concern about suicide, your interest in studying suicide, that began early for you.
Began way back, yes. I am a survivor, meaning that I was close to someone who ended their life when I was very young. Obviously, that had a profound impact on me and actually got me interested in wanting to be a psychologist, study suicide, and provide services in the area of suicide, prevention, intervention, and postvention. I also had an extended family member who was bipolar, made multiple suicide attempts, so that also had a very powerful impact on me at a pretty young age. So the seeds were sown very, very early for me, and for essentially my entire career, it's been both a personal and a professional interest.
Losing any loved one to death, I mean, is a very painful experience. But losing someone to suicide is painful in some particular ways. What defines this kind of experience for a survivor? What kinds of things do we feel?
Right. Well, the first thing I'd say about that, and I'll probably say this repeatedly today, is every situation is different. It's really hard to extrapolate from one person to another in terms of suicide. But in my experience, there's just a huge range of emotions that occur for survivors. And they are some of the obvious emotions you might think of initially, obviously grief and mourning and disbelief many times. Another emotion that many people, not everyone, but many survivors have is anger towards the person. They can't believe the person did this. Many, many people will say, I never saw this coming. I can't believe that they did this. And they will also feel guilty, feel like they missed something. They should have anticipated something that might have prevented the suicide. But one of my responses to that is that even though there's been a massive amount of research and intervention, in many ways we still don't know exactly why people do this. We know a lot of the risk factors. We've studied it extensively, seen many patients who deal with it. But again, ultimately, harm to self and harm to others as well is extremely difficult to predict.
And to prevent.
Yes. I think there are things we can do to prevent it. I think, you know, we've made great strides in that area. But so many people have said to me, as I said, I just didn't see this coming, and they feel initially many times a lot of guilt.
Let's talk about people who are particularly at risk for death by suicide. How do you identify someone who may be in danger?
Right. Again, everyone's different. There's a massive list of risk factors, and time doesn't permit going through all of them, but I want to mention a number of them that I think are particularly important. First of all, most suicidal people don't really want to die. They want to stop living, a subtle but very important distinction. It's not so much that they want to get to the point of death as that they want to get away from their current life situation. So obviously, if we can come up with ways to mitigate that, to help them find other ways to cope with their current life situation, we can often get them through the crisis. Most suicidal people feel helpless and hopeless. Helpless, there's nothing I can do about this, and hopeless, it's never going to change. Very powerful combination that we actually see in a lot of mental health areas, but it's particularly powerful in terms of suicide. There can be situations that create suicidal risk. Loss is one of the biggest examples. Obviously, many suicidal people, though not all, but most, in my opinion, are depressed. So many of the classical symptoms of depression are warning signs. Suicide can often be comorbid with alcohol and drug abuse, so we always get concerned about substance abuse. Having attempted in the past is a pretty significant risk factor. There are different studies about this. The numbers are kind of disparate, but in my personal view and the view of many suicidologists, if somebody has attempted in the past, that it definitely raises their risk level now. Again, that doesn't guarantee that's going to happen, but it raises our level of concern. Suicide does run in families. Depression runs in families. But, of course, everything runs in families, diabetes, heart disease. But if there's a history in the family, that raises our concern. A number of diagnoses in the area of mental health and well-being, certain diagnoses raise our level of concern. Most common would probably – a number of them, but the ones at the top of my list would probably be many of the mood disorders, depression, bipolar disorder, this kind of thing. But we see it in many diagnoses. We see it in eating disorders. We see it with substance abuse, quite a few, actually. Impulsivity, people who are impulsive, raise my level of concern because we don't quite know what they're going to do. They may act in a very impulsive way in terms of a suicide attempt. Low self-concept, which we see in so many different areas in social work and counseling and psychology and psychiatry, raises our level of concern about many things. But people who have a poor self-concept, that's another very significant risk factor. You mentioned exposure to another person's suicide, so that suicide can be a modeled behavior, so that if people are around someone else, know someone else, or exposed to it, that may raise our level of risk. And experiencing violence or victimization in the person's past, which is a huge category. It includes many things, but that's another risk factor that's important. So there are a lot of them. I think the question that has befuddled us for many years is, you know, there are many people that have those kinds of characteristics. What is it that pushes some people to suicide and other people not? And I think that's still something we're really trying to figure out.
I think for a long time, and probably a lot of people still feel this way, there's this idea that if we talk about suicide, we will give people the idea. So it's better not to bring it up.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
So that remains a pretty pervasive myth. In my opinion, it's a lot less of a myth than it used to be 15 or 20 years ago, but that's still a perception.
Or less common myth.
Yeah, less common than it used to be. It still persists out there, and the evidence is pretty overwhelming that you're much more likely to save a life than cause a suicide by bringing this up. If you're concerned, someone may be suicidal. I think in suicidology, anything is possible, I think. It's conceivable that by bringing it up, it could trigger something, but overwhelmingly the data says that if you're concerned about someone, if you think they may be suicidal, it's important to get the issue on the table, inquire, and help them hopefully get into treatment.
So how do you bring that up? Because that's a pretty scary question to ask somebody.
So there, people have all different ways of bringing it up. There's no right or wrong way. For me, the way that I typically do that is if I feel it's risen to the level of concern where it needs to be brought up, I'll say something like, have you been feeling so badly lately that you've thought about harming yourself? Is your safety at risk? There are a lot of different ways to do it. The key, though, is to do it, and then many times if the person indicates that they may be suicidal, a big step from that point on is trying to get them into treatment. Call a crisis line, get them into treatment, get them in to see someone. I think the challenge for many people is when does it rise to the level of asking that question? Again, something that is a very difficult call to make. For lay people.
Well, you mentioned calling a crisis line. That brings Carrie Neblett into the conversation. She is Crisis Intervention Services Director at the Crisis Center of Johnson County. She's also a board member of the Iowa chapter of the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And I asked John earlier what brought him to this kind of work. How about you? What brought you to this kind of work?
Well, I actually started my college career wanting to be an accountant. which is a very far cry from where I am now. But after about 2 years of business school, I decided that I wanted to change focus. And I remembered in high school, people said I should go into psychology because I was a good listener. And so I actually volunteered at the crisis center on their crisis line for 5 years when I was in undergrad. And I was really amazed by the difference I could make on the phone with somebody that was thinking of suicide. I had a call. I can't talk about specifics because of confidentiality, but I want to give you a general idea of the call. There was a veteran who was upset because at the time there were a lot of protests of the war. And he was really upset. He felt disrespected. And I was able to provide that connection to him so that he felt like I really understood. He asked me if I was a veteran, even though I was actually one of the ones that was against the war. But he really felt heard, and it really changed his perspective on suicide at that point. And that moment was so powerful that it really made me want to focus on suicide prevention.
So a powerful, empowering moment for you as well. I mean, we were talking earlier about how, you know, when you lose someone by suicide, there are all of these questions. And one of the big questions, of course, is could I have done something to prevent this? And so I think it's important to talk about in any conversation about prevention, about not laying the blame on survivors. Is
right.
that a concern that you have sometimes in focusing on prevention?
It is. It's one thing that's always on my mind, because when I go out and do prevention talks, there are going to be people who've lost loved ones to suicide. And I want to make sure that I don't further that guilt that they're feeling. And I actually am a survivor of suicide loss. I lost a friend about 5 years ago to suicide. And it was hard for me in the suicide prevention field to not feel that guilt.
Right.
And I had to wrestle with that myself. So I'm really sensitive to that.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Carrie Neblett is here from the Crisis Center of Johnson County, and also John Westerfield, an emeritus professor in the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about suicide. We're talking about how to support survivors of suicide loss. We're talking about prevention and postvention opportunities when it comes to suicide. With me this hour, Carrie Neblett of the Crisis Center of Johnson County, also John Westerfield, Professor Emeritus in the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Iowa. You're welcome to join the conversation also. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Carrie, just before the break, we were talking about your work with the Crisis Center, and we also, John and I were talking earlier about how there is this idea that if we talk about suicide, we'll give people the idea, and that actually spreads it. It's a myth. But in holding suicide prevention workshops, has there been resistance to the idea that, you know, sitting down with a bunch of teenagers and talking about suicide, maybe that's a bad idea?
There has been a little resistance, but I think that ultimately people are fearful. And when I can allay that fear, that helps get me in the door so that I can talk about suicide. One of the things John mentioned is you know, it's a myth, but they actually had a study a few years ago where it showed that just asking the question about suicide decreases people's risk of suicide. And I think that the reason is because the person that's thinking of suicide really, really wants to talk about it, but they're just scared. They're afraid of being judged, and it's a taboo subject. And so when you ask somebody about suicide, you show that concern, you show that care, and that willingness to sit with them. And I think that's so important. And people that are thinking of suicide oftentimes feel alone and that nobody understands. And if they have somebody that can sit with them and really connect, that alone can decrease their risk of suicide.
And John, you had something to add?
Yeah, I think Carrie's making a really excellent point. And I just want to add that, kind of reinforcing what she said, that in my experience, many suicidal people, again, not all, but many, are embarrassed about how they feel, if not ashamed of how they feel. So it's very difficult for them to bring this up. Even in a first therapy session, it's rare that someone will come in and when you ask them, how can I help you while you're here, that they'll say, I'm here because I'm suicidal. And so it's very hard for them to initiate a conversation about this. But if we throw them the lifeline, if we bring it up, whether it's a loved one, a therapist, the crisis center, many times they're grateful that they've been given permission to talk about their pain. So it's hard for them to initiate the conversation. But if we initiate it, many, many times they'll grab onto that lifeline and be appreciative of the fact that we asked.
I want to go to the phones. Father Jim is on the line in Sumner. Hi, Father Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you today?
Good. Thank you so much for calling. And you are a suicide loss survivor. What happened?
That's correct. My father suffered bipolar disorder and took his life about 15 years ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
And you, being a Catholic priest, you not only have had to deal with that grief and that loss, but this is a difficult subject in the Catholic Church, isn't it?
Well, it's a really, really important conversation because we're getting into the question of how do we believe God responds to suicide. And so in the past 100 years, especially as psychological knowledge has advanced, so has how the church responds to suicide. Before, it was viewed as this great social taboo, and you didn't talk about it, and it was understood as the gravest sin that you could commit because you were taking your life, which God had given. But as we've come to understand that it's not necessarily a conscious, well-thought-out, intentional decision, but more of a response to a great pain and internal distress that someone's experiencing, less and less it's felt that the person's held accountable, but it's understood that God's mercy is extended, especially to people who are hurting so badly that they don't see other options. Now, before in the church, a person might not even be granted a funeral or be allowed to have their body buried in a sacred ground. But now the message is clearly one of we want to bring God's mercy to this situation. We trust that it's extended to the person who has taken their life, and we extend that mercy as well, especially to those who grieve and are hurting because of what has taken place. So the response of the community in the church is to gather around such people and to support them and to help them to walk that journey because it's going to affect them for the rest of their lives.
Well, Father Jim, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. And again, I'm so sorry for your loss. Father Jim brings up a really important point, not just within the Catholic Church and within other churches, but there has been a change, a very thoughtful change in how we talk about suicide. I mean, just not that long ago, when you talked about someone taking their life by suicide, you would say they committed suicide. And that kind of language is not something you hear very often anymore. Carrie, why do you think the language change is important?
Well, I think with that one in particular, the commit suicide, suicide a long time ago used to be illegal. And so you would commit murder, you commit suicide. And that switch to it being a mental health issue really changed that language. And I credit the survivors of suicide loss because they really band together and started this push to say, you know, my loved one didn't do something illegal. You know, he was in pain. And so we like to say died by suicide or died of suicide, or sometimes you see people saying died of depression or died of bipolar, to really emphasize that it's a mental health concern.
John?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I think Father Jim's comment illustrates for me a a big issue, which is a number of things that have changed about suicide over the years. When I first came into the field, it was very, very rare that, for example, a high school would have a suicide prevention workshop, much less a junior high school, or many community groups for that matter, because of this perception that if we talk about it, we're going to give people the idea. I still find there's some resistance to that, but I find that there's a lot less resistance to that than it used to be. I think more people are more open to seeking mental health services. There's still a stigma for some people, certainly, but I think the stigma has reduced a lot. And I think in general, suicide is just on the table a lot more. I think it's more openly discussed. People are more willing to have more open conversations about it. And one final kind of simple but I think very telling example of that, and I don't have any data on this, it's just kind of a perception I have, but when I first started working in this area, it was extremely unusual that suicide would be listed as a cause of death in an obituary. More and more now, we see that people will list it in some way. They word it in different ways, but they're willing to acknowledge it. And in my opinion, I'm sure that's been very difficult for some families to do that, but I think it's another indication of the fact that people are more willing to talk about this.
We're talking about suicide, suicide prevention and postvention and support for survivors this hour. My guest is John Westerfield, Professor Emeritus in the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Iowa. And Carrie Neblett is here. She is Crisis Intervention Services Director at the Crisis Center of Johnson County, also a board member of the Iowa Chapter of the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And John is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I wanted to, share some experiences I had and get your...
John's line just dropped. Sorry about that, John. If you're listening, please give us a call back. I think the line accidentally just got dropped. John was beginning to ask about support for people who are thinking about suicide. Okay, I think we can actually hit him back now. John, are you there?
I am.
Oh,
yes, I can
good.
Hear you fine.
Okay, great. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt you. So, what were you bringing up? You were talking about your personal experiences.
Yeah. So I went to get help. First through a counselor, and, you know, at one point I said something that spooked the counselor, and she started to call the police. And then I had a particularly bad night. I knew I needed help that night, and I went into a hospital on the advice of the counselor, and all of a sudden I was put on a 48-hour hold. I mean, I went in expecting to find a grief counselor to help me through it, much like the 800 numbers. And instead, I was arrested and sent to Cedar Rapids. You know, as a result, she could have very easily used that to take my children. I fell behind on my work because I was in hold for 48 hours. And I understand there are laws to protect you, which works great on paper. But in reality, you risk your children, you risk your job, you risk your freedom if you go in for help and you say the wrong thing. And so I was wondering if you've ever heard of experiences like that, if people are afraid to go into help, not because of the taboo, but because of the ramifications.
Right. John, I'm so sorry that you went through that. Carrie, you do have a response to that.
Yes, John, I would like to say once again, sorry for what happened. That should not have happened. And that's actually one thing that I've been really active in doing is trying to teach social workers and psychologists and psychiatrists what the level of risk is and when you need to be put somebody in the hospital and when you can create a safety plan and keep them at home with supports. And a lot of times, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists don't have a lot of training in suicide specifically, and they get scared. They have this fear that crops up that really kind of, you know, they said the word suicide, take them away. That is not But based on what John said and also what I've heard from millions, not millions, sorry,
many,
hundreds,
right?
many of people that had the same thing happen, we at the Crisis Center, we will only, you know, if you call the crisis line, the only time that we will send the police is if we feel like you're not working with us anymore and that if you hang up the phone, you're going to actually kill yourself that night. And so people can talk about suicide. They can talk about their feelings. They can get help without that fear of it getting to that level.
Well, it's frustrating because John clearly was asking for help.
Yep.
and taking significant steps in actually going to see a therapist. Do you feel like it's safer for people to reach out through a suicide prevention hotline?
It really depends on the therapist. And I think one thing that that people may do is when they talk to their therapist, if they want to bring up the concern of suicide, to say, do you have a lot of experience working with people thinking of suicide? And that opens up the dialogue so that you can see how comfortable that therapist is. But if you're thinking of suicide, I would encourage you to tell somebody, no matter what, because it's something that's so scary and it's not something that you should do alone. You need help. And people are here to help, and I think that's important. We also have a lot of ways for people to access help. There's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255. That'll get you to the closest crisis center from where you're calling. They also have chat available, so you can go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org, and there's a button that says click here to connect to a counselor. And you can chat through instant message. There's also some texting programs out there that you could reach out. If you Google suicide prevention, all the resources are there for you. And there's so many different ways. So however you feel comfortable, you can ask for help.
So there are a lot of local support groups like the Crisis Center in Johnson County. There are a lot of those around. Mm-hmm. But the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is maybe the easiest way for people to get in touch even with their local support?
Right. So if you're calling from like Johnson County or some of the more rural areas in Iowa, you will get the Crisis Center of Johnson County will answer that call. And so if you're calling from Linn County, Foundation 2, there, it's a crisis center in Linn County, they will answer that call. So you'll really get the people that are local. You won't be talking to somebody in New York that doesn't understand your situation. It's four people from Iowa will get people from Iowa.
There are a lot of people concerned about a lack of mental health care, particularly in rural areas of Iowa. This is a big issue in the state. If you call from a rural area that is not covered, doesn't have a crisis center nearby, would you still be connected with somebody in the state?
Yes. So if you call from a rural area in Iowa, you will either get the Crisis Center of Johnson County or Foundation 2, and we're both located in Iowa.
All right. You are welcome to join the conversation here at 866-780-9100. Charles is on the line in Indianola. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
Hi.
Very interesting program, very important.
Thank you.
I would like to ask the psychologist, considering the guilt that people, that the survivors have, if a person is absolutely bent on suicide and they are extremely close, what is the really first or second thing and or second thing that the lay person should do to help this person? And also, how honest do you think people are when they come into your office? You spoke about they're sometimes being reluctant to say, but I see this on doctors' forms. Your answer, have you thought about harming yourself? And I've often wondered, do people really answer that honestly? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Charles. And let's take the first question first. If you know someone, love someone who is suicidal, what's the most important thing to do? What can you do?
Well, both excellent questions. In terms of the first step, again, there's some difference of opinion about this, but I'll give you my opinion. I think the most important thing is to reach out to the person and ask what many suicidologists call the question, you know, words along the lines of, have you been feeling so badly lately you thought about harming yourself? And depending on that answer, I do think most people are honest. Again, we don't really have data on that, but my opinion is that most people are. The problem is they're often ambivalent. So some people will say, well, absolutely, John, no, I would not do that. And some would say, well, I really think I might be at risk. Unfortunately, quite a few people will say, well, I don't really know. I'm not sure about that. So that, I think, is the most important first step. And then it becomes a matter of, if there is risk, trying to get the person to go into treatment, to seek help. And if we have time, we can talk about a few strategies for doing that. That remains a very important kind of issue. Again, if people are honest on the form, I think most of the time they are, but of course there's no way to know that for sure.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour we're talking about suicide, suicide prevention and postvention, support for survivors of suicide loss. And you're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me this hour, Carrie Neblett of the Crisis Center of Johnson County. We also have John Westerfield, Professor Emeritus in the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Iowa. And John, just before the break, we were responding to a question, and you were talking about what you can do if someone in your life gives signs of being suicidal.
Right.
How can you help?
Yeah, I wanted to make two more points about two additional resources. The first is it's important that people realize that it doesn't only have to be the person in distress who calls a crisis line, goes to see a therapist, consults with a mental health professional. I've had many people, I'm sure Carrie has too, consult me who are worried about someone else. So it's not uncommon at all for people to call in or come in to see someone in terms of getting assistance for what to do about someone who they're concerned about. And I want to mention one other quick resource. Carrie mentioned the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is very important. Just to mention that number again, it's 800-273-8255. The best web resource I know about is the American Association of Suicidology. And this is an organization that has an annual convention for both mental health professionals and survivors. They have a massive number of resources. The website has a tremendous amount of information for both professionals, for survivors, and for people who are concerned about someone else or themselves. So those are just two additional resources I just want to make sure people knew about.
We have this question that's on the same topic from Reverend Gary Nims in Des Moines. He said, one place people can be alert to someone thinking about suicide is on social media. What are some of the potential warning signs, and how can you respond if you see something that's concerning? Carrie, I mean, that's a place where sometimes people have put out a cry for help.
Yeah, I've actually intervened in a friend of mine who put a post on Facebook that sounded so hopeless that I called her and said, are you doing okay? You know, I'm worried about you. This sounds like you're thinking of suicide. I'm wondering what's going on. And so if you see a concerning post that says something like, I can't go on anymore, you know, life sucks, it's not worth it, those types of things, on Facebook, there's a way to actually report that to Facebook. And Facebook has a partnership with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline where they can get resources to that person that you're reporting. And so it's not, you know, you're doing something wrong. It's more someone is concerned about you and here's how to get them help. But I think it's so important, even if it's uncomfortable for you, it's so important to make that phone call, to send a Facebook message back. That, you know, I actually did that one time because it was a person in the community that I knew, but I didn't really know her. Mm-hmm. And so I sent her a Facebook message.
So, well, and I can imagine thinking, especially on Facebook or other kinds of social media, on Instagram or on Twitter, if you see something like that, you would think, well, someone else will respond. But it's important not to think that.
Right, because if everybody thinks that, then nobody responds. And I think with suicide, it's very similar to the law enforcement saying that, you know, if you see something, say something. It's very similar in suicide, too. If you're concerned about somebody, say something. And if you don't feel like you're the one that can say it, You know, if it's just so uncomfortable or your relationship with that person is tenuous, then talk to somebody else that knows them and ask them to talk to them about it. Because it could be a life or death situation.
We've talked a lot about how difficult suicide loss is for survivors, and I want to focus on that for a little while now. Sherry Jenkins is a facilitator of Families of Suicide Loss Support Group in Davenport. She herself is a survivor of suicide loss, and that has led her to help others who are trying to move forward in the wake of this kind of tragedy. And she is with us on the line now. Hello, Sherry.
Hello. Thank you very much, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And tell us about your story.
Absolutely. On September 22nd of 2011, I got a phone call from my brother telling me that my father had completed suicide. 12 days later, I got a call from my sister that had told me that my mother had completed suicide as well. So two suicide deaths within 12 days of each other have wreaked havoc on my family.
Well, and let's talk about some of the emotions that you went through going through this kind of loss, because, you know, every situation is different, but with suicide loss, there are some common emotions that people feel.
Absolutely. Anger is one, and devastation, denial, how could this happen? Why did it happen? There's so many unanswered questions that they leave behind. I think whether they leave a note or not, there's still those unanswered questions of why. How was life so bad that they didn't pick the phone call up or they didn't reach out to someone to say, hey, I'm having a bad day, or this is the thoughts that I'm feeling. But it's devastating, and it's devastating to family, to friends, you know, and then when you have them back to back, I think that's a lot devastating as well.
Absolutely. And we talk a lot about when people go through the stages of grief, you move back and forth. It's not like a linear journey. But I know for you, along with the grief, the anger has come back again and again.
Absolutely. And we call that, in our group, we call that the roller coaster of the emotions, you know, and it may be angry one day and sad the next day and guilt the next day, or you might be okay for a couple of weeks and then you might hear a song or you see something and it triggers those emotions all over again, you know, and anger has come and gone with me, and I did seek an individual counselor right after I got home from my mom's funeral, and she gave me some great advice, and she said, you know, if you're angry, write a letter to your mom or your dad and say, why are you angry? Why are you pissed off? And this is why. And then I take it and I burn it and I let it go at that time. I've done that a couple of times because I've been on that roller coaster, and it's 5 years. You know, I'm coming up on 6 years in August and September, or excuse me, September and October. And like I said, some days are easier than others.
The counselor was able to help you, but she wasn't somebody who had dealt with suicide personally, and that was hard for you.
Absolutely.
So that led you to a support group. What do you feel the support group was able to do for you that maybe a counselor couldn't?
Absolutely. The support group let me know that my feelings were validated, that my emotions that I had was what the next person that was had also lost somebody, they were going through that. To let me know that I was not alone, that there are other people that have lost someone to suicide that are there. And talking about it has helped tremendous amounts for me. And in our group, we don't give advice, but we give suggestions for new people that have come in that, and they may be just recently had lost somebody or been lost somebody years ago, but just new to our group. We do tell them that we are not here to give advice. We are here to give you suggestions that have helped us, and it may or may not help that person, or they might hear something from somebody else in our group, and they may say, oh, well, I might try that. So talking about it has helped a lot.
we've talked about the anger. Did that make it hard? Does it make it hard for you to focus on your love for your mom and your stepdad and who they were when they were living?
No, that didn't, because they were still my parents. I know they still love me. And for whatever reason that they took their lives, I will never know. But still, I have the memories, the good times, and that's what I remember.
With your support group, how long do people come? I mean, this is, you're coming up on your sixth anniversary, and obviously you're helping other people. Suicide loss is something that hurts for a long, long time.
Absolutely. And we have people that come and go in our group. We have one person, his brother had completed suicide over 29 years ago. So he comes when he needs to. He doesn't come every, every month, but he comes when he needs to. And, you know, and that's a big support to let me know as well in my recovery and my journey that, hey, it does get easier. It never goes away. And that reminds me of that.
When you have someone in your life who's going through a period of grief, it's hard to know what to say. I think when that someone has lost someone they love to suicide, it's even harder to know what to say. When you lost your parents, what helped the most? What did friends say and do that really meant something to you?
Absolutely. My first of all, most and foremost, my husband, picked me up off of the ground and said to me, "What do you need?" I'm sorry.
It's okay. And that was exactly what you needed to hear.
That is exactly what I, yes, absolutely. Friends that I had grown up with when I got to Florida were there. And that was, you know, what do you need us to do? That is a big help. And even if it was just a cup of coffee or a hug, if somebody's offering, take that. If that's all you need and somebody says, "What can I do?" just say, "Sit down and let me cry." And that's okay.
I think, like I said, a lot of us are afraid of saying the wrong thing. And I'll ask you, Carrie, you know, a lot of people say really stupid things about suicide. So it's possible to say the wrong thing.
Certainly.
But as you were saying earlier, if you see somebody at risk, you should say something. Does the same thing go for comforting survivors?
I believe that when somebody is grieving, they need to talk about their loved one. And sometimes what suicide does, it's that fear again. It makes people shut down and think, oh, we shouldn't talk about this. And so it's important, if you know somebody who's lost a loved one to suicide, that you say that person's name to the person who lost them and tell them, you know, ask them about memories they have about the person. And like Sherry said, just sit with them. Sit with them and let them cry, or cry with them. I think that's the most important thing.
Well, Sherry Jenkins, thank you so much for being here today and for sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
Sherry Jenkins is a facilitator of Families of Suicide Loss Support Group in Davenport, herself a survivor of suicide loss. And before we run out of time, I want to ask about a very troubling pattern that happens so often with suicide, and that is that if one person in a community takes their life, then often others will as well. This is something we've seen in high schools, something we've seen in many groups. What can we do in the wake of a suicide loss to prevent more suicides? Carrie?
Well, I think there's a lot you can do. And one of the most important things is to be there for people, to let them know what the resources are. And to kind of say, yeah, it's okay to get help. It's okay if you're thinking this way. And the other thing, it's really important to use the same policies that you use when somebody else has died by a different cause, so that that person of person that has been lost by suicide isn't treated differently. But in saying that, it's really important that your policies don't make it so that that person is kind of idolized in a way, making it glamorous. And a lot of the people in suicidology feel that a really good ceremony that focuses on maybe raising money for a suicide cause or something like that is much better than having a bench with that person's name on it or that type of thing. Because a lot of times people are feeling alone and they feel like nobody sees them. And this person getting all the recognition for the suicide makes other people think, well, people will know my name if I die. And so it's a balance. It's a really tough balance that we have to struggle with as a society, is how to honor that person's life without glamorizing their death.
And is this something particularly young people are at risk for?
Right, right. And I think that it's also important to monitor if the person was on social media, to monitor their page, because people will comment on the person that's died's page. And a lot of times they'll say, I'll be with you soon, or, you know, comments like that. So parents and administration and the schools can monitor those and pick out those statements that are concerning and then go get that person help.
And this, of course, is called postvention. You do a lot of prevention workshops. So when there's a loss, let's say, in a school, does the crisis center come in at that point as well?
Well, with the schools, they have their own team that does that support. But the crisis center has gone to several businesses where an employee has died by suicide to really help and debrief and help people talk about it, to share those memories, to share the guilt that they're feeling, and to help them heal in a way from that suicide.
We're nearly out of time, but I would love for both of you to leave us with just a thought. I mean, this hour we've talked a lot about suicide. This is a subject that's difficult for people to talk about. What do you think the most important thing for people to know about suicide is, John?
Well, two things I want to say. First, thank you for doing the show. I'm a great believer in getting this topic out there and talking about it. So I think it's a tremendous public service whenever the topic is discussed. The second thing is I just want to leave people with the national phone number, which, again, is 800-273-8255. If you're concerned about either yourself or someone else, please call that number.
All right. Carrie, a final message?
There's one other resource I wanted to share with people. It's the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP.org. They have tons of resources for people who've lost a loved one to suicide. So I would check that out.
All right. Carrie Neblett, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Carrie Neblett of the Crisis Center of Johnson County. And John Westerfeld, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Westerfeld, Professor Emeritus of the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.